The following program is produced and paid for by Star Arizona.
You're listening to Star Arizona's Let's Talk Stars with your hosts, David and Wendy Levy. David is the science editor of Parade Magazine, the author of over 24 books, and the discoverer of 21 comets, including Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9. David and Wendy can also be heard on the World Wide Web at letstalkstars.com. Now here's David and Wendy.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Let's Talk Stars. It's just David this afternoon. Wendy is in Albuquerque. We are expecting the birth of our grandson any moment. Wouldn't it be nice if that happened right on the show? We've had a suggestion that we actually name, that the baby be named Let's Talk Stars, but we are resisting that, you'll be happy to know. Well, here we are. We have another show, another week, and another time of the year. The fall in Arizona is one of the very best parts of the year for observing. It's a time of year when the sky tends to be clear at night. We can get day after day after day of clear skies, low humidity. We haven't really had a whole lot of that this fall. We've had a series of small impulses moving through Tucson that's caused a lot of clouds and a lot of difficulty. Fortunately, none of these little mini storms has affected the morning hours of the night. And in those early hours before dawn, I've been outside with a small telescope, my 6-inch reflector, Minerva, along with a CCD, looking for comets. And haven't found anything yet, but we're hoping to get somewhere eventually. Comets, galaxies, stars, all kinds of things. In astronomy, we have specialists in just about every aspect of astronomy. You could get a specialist on comets, or several of them. We've had people on our show talking about comets. You can get a specialist on certain types of stars, on certain specific types of variable stars. We can get specialists on galaxies and specialists within galaxies on specific types of galaxies, or how they work with each other, how they interact with one another. Specialists on the expansion of the universe, on the age of the universe. The number of fields in astronomy is almost as endless as the universe itself. But today we have a guest whose field is not so much a particular object or a type of object in astronomy, but in a way of observing all kinds of objects. Our guest today is Don McCarthy, whose specialty is in observing objects in the infrared. Hello, Don. How are you and welcome?
Hi, David. It's great to be with you.
Thanks. We've actually known each other a long time, and you've done amazing things with infrared detectors. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the interesting thing is that in the infrared, if you had infrared eyes, you'd see a whole different universe. And I've been able to look at volcanoes on Jupiter's moon Io from the heat that they give off. Or infrared allows you to look through dusty regions mm-hmm. in the galaxy, and so you can look at the region around the black hole mm-hmm. in the center of the Milky Way. Or into the centers of other galaxies. Or to potentially look for the heat emission from planets around other stars, which is an area we're really focusing on at the university.
It's interesting. I'm just imagining if I were to see, well, here we have Chapman over there. He's wearing kind of a red, our producer. He's wearing kind of a reddish shirt right now. If I could see in the infrared, if we could see in the infrared rather than in the visible, we would be able to see a very different view of Chapman Broach than we see now, right?
You sure would.
What would he look like?
Well, his head would be glowing very brightly. I think something like 20% of your body heat's supposed to come out of your head, so that's a good reason for wearing a hat in the winter. But his eyes would light up. His nose would be cold. His cheeks would be cold. And
you'd actually see that in an infrared view of our producer.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm fond of showing a video in my class. I just showed it last week to U of A students where there's an infrared camera taking a picture of a truck on a normal street corner mm-hmm. during the day. And they can see the hot exhaust coming out and various aspects of the truck. But then the truck drives away and it leaves its shadow behind on the ground.
Oh, really?
because the ground was cool.
Yeah.
Since it was shielded from the sunlight. And so what you see in the infrared is what appears to be a cold shadow, mm-hmm. but it's not really the shadow. It's just where it was shielded from the sun.
And, well, getting back to Chapman, if Chapman were to be drinking a cup of coffee, would we actually be able to detect it going down?
Well, not maybe real deep within inside of him, but a fun trick is for him, let's say, to take an ice cube and paint his forehead, and then it would look very dark because his forehead would temporarily be very cold.
It's kind of an interesting way. It's a different reality. And well, can you imagine if our eyes were infrared eyes rather than visible, we would see the world in a very different way.
Well, yeah. You know, my red vision is not very acute, so mm-hmm. I get teased a lot about being an infrared astronomer to compensate for my physiology. But, one of the things you notice in the infrared is that your surroundings are glowing very brightly, including the air above us. And so at some parts of the infrared spectrum of light, the atmosphere is glowing millions of times more. It's sending millions of times more light to you than the brightest mm-hmm. objects outside of the solar system are. So you have to develop some techniques for canceling out what we call background mm-hmm. emission. And it's not, that background is not stable. It's also changing all the time. So there's a lot of engineering in it.
How did you get interested in astronomy? How did your long march towards where you are now begin?
I remember in like the mid-50s being in third grade when the space race began. This was in the Minneapolis, Minnesota area. A company in Minnesota named Sheldahl, I believe, had built a Mylar inflatable balloon that would inflate in orbit and people could bounce radio signals off of it for communication purposes. And so I can still see, as we talk, this bright blip going across the Minnesota sky. And I wrote the company, and they sent me a sample of the material. But I really got fascinated by the space program, that tremendous era of exploration. And I always wanted to be a part of that and never really lost sight of wanting to be a part of it. And as I grew older, I realized that I could explore in other ways besides just being up there. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of why I'm still interested in astronomy, because of the exploring part of it.
Well, exploring is, to me, the most exciting part about being there. And whether you are, one of the things we want to talk about later is the work that you're doing in education, getting young people going into astronomy. But it's so great to be able to go into a classroom or into a summer camp or some situation and talk to children that can tell them that our planet is only one of a community of worlds. And beyond that, there's stars and galaxies that are just beckoning for our interest and attention.
Children really light up at this subject. Studying the stars or galaxies or planets is really fascinating to them. Kids like dinosaurs, too, yeah. But they really get into astronomy. And I really believe that, you know, the seeds of their careers and their success in education is fostered by, you know, generating enthusiasm mm-hmm. at a young age. And astronomy seems to just do that naturally, and we ought to capitalize on it.
Well, I think so. But let's say we get one of these children really excited about astronomy, and she wants to become an astronomer, and she wants to see all the infrared objects that are good in the infrared the way you do. And so she goes to a store, and she buys herself an infrared telescope. She puts in an eyepiece, and she finds herself a little disappointed having a telescope in her backyard that sees things in the infrared. And then it turns out that really to do very well in the infrared, you have to be above much of our atmosphere. Water vapor is the real enemy of infrared observations, is it not?
Well, it is. Water and CO2 and yeah. even ozone. But we speak of what are called windows in the atmosphere, windows of transmission where certain infrared wavelength bands actually do reach the Earth's surface. Some more efficiently than others. So there are some parts of the infrared spectrum where this girl and her imaginary infrared telescope would be quite successful. In fact, there might be less light pollution because she's mm-hmm. observing in the infrared. But it takes obviously a certain kind of detector besides the eyes. So I wish there were an infrared eyepiece.
Well, when people come to NASA and National Science Foundation and they say, we want to fund an infrared telescope, invariably they want to put that telescope on the highest possible mountain peak. And so really the most effective way to observe in the infrared is to get above most of the atmosphere.
That's right. And it also helps to have it cold and yeah. dry at the same time. And that's why Mount Lemmon, to the north of Tucson, has played a fundamental role in the history of infrared mm-hmm. astronomy. Some of the very first infrared telescopes mm-hmm. were built and operated there in the late 60s and 70s. That's a very rich tradition in the origin of infrared work.
Well, tell me about what some of the objects that you've studied in the infrared.
Well, I've been able to dabble from near to far. Mm-hmm. So most recently, I've been interested in solar system objects, such as mapping the mineral deposits, if you will, on the asteroid Vesta. Or we have used large telescopes to resolve the details in some of the volcanoes on Jupiter's moon Io. Most recently, we've been looking at Kuiper Belt objects, those icy objects beyond the orbit of Pluto, and trying to figure out what they're made of. If you could take a spectrum in the infrared of a Kuiper Belt object, you'd see absorption because of certain kinds of ice, water ice included. In fact, water ice is very common. And we discovered a spot on one of these objects where the spectrum shows water ice sometimes, but not at other times, because the object is rotating and the light from this spot comes into our field of view and then goes away periodically every mm-hmm. few hours. I really spent most of my time looking for what you might call planets around other stars. Mm-hmm. Some people call heavy objects like this brown dwarfs, objects that are not quite stars and not quite planets.
What is a brown dwarf, actually? And I know that this getting into this area of your work is getting into other things, specifically Van Biesburg 8b. What is a brown dwarf? I mean, that listeners are going to wonder about, you know, are we talking about some kind of an animal or what, you know?
Well, stars are like people in many ways, and one of the ways is they come with different masses. And the very lightest weight stars we know of, we have called historically red dwarfs.
There's one actually nearby, but 4 light years away, Proxima Centauri.
That's right. Well, we believe there's a theoretical limit to how small a star can be and still generate its own energy, which is really the definition of a star. And that would be about 8% the mass of the sun, mm-hmm. or in planetary terms, it would be 80 Jupiters in mass. So historically, we've called the region between planets and stars brown dwarfs. The region between a few Jupiter masses and 80 Jupiter masses. The term was interestingly coined by an astronomer named Jill Tarter, who, if I could put in a plug here, sure. is actually going to give a public evening talk this Thursday night about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence in the Stewart Observatory Auditorium.
I heard it. Now, Jill is with the SETI Institute.
That's right.
And she's really been extremely active in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And tell me where the talk is going to be.
The talk is on the university campus. In the area of, well, right across from the planetarium, close to University and Cherry, mm-hmm. where Stewart Observatory has its building.
Well, it'll be in the public lecture room at Stewart Observatory.
That's right.
And admission is free, and it's this Thursday evening at
7:30 p.m. And I'm sure it'll be crowded. I've hyped this to all my students, so you want to come early.
Yeah, it's actually a fascinating subject. You know, I just had an article in Parade this last week about about the same thing, about the not so much the search for extraterrestrial life, but the search for planets in other solar systems, which is really part and parcel of this whole question. If we're going to be finding life out there, we really would like to find where that life lives.
Well, that's right. Yeah. The reason that Jill Tarter's coming to town is because I'm advising a graduate student who works in the SETI area, and she has to have a very important examination this Friday, and Jill is on the committee.
Ah.
So my student has actually been trying to select the stars that SETI would observe, you know, for the purpose mm-hmm. of finding intelligent life. So she's gone through all these factors. What kind of star? How far away from the star does the planet have to be? And so on and so on. Many, many factors. And she has a list of about 15,000 stars they'd like to look at.
15,000?
Yeah.
Well, how do you look at 15,000 stars for evidence that there may be worlds around them with intelligent life on them?
Well, the SETI technique is done at radio wavelengths, and so they're looking for radio signals that have a pattern to them. And so they have to individually look at these stars and see if their radio emission has some kind of pattern to it. Interestingly enough, there's this SETI homepage or SETI screensaver.
SETI at home.
SETI at home, that where you can automatically have your computer go into searching for these patterns mm-hmm. on real data. It's fascinating.
It's amazing. It actually runs while you're not using the computer for anything else, or if your computer is very powerful, you can run it along with everything else you're doing. My computer is kind of a little bit like me. It's single task. I can't multitask very well, and so I didn't do all that well with SETI at home, and didn't find anything with SETI at home. No ETs out there, at least on my watch.
Well, you know, it's quite a debate. On the one hand, you might say you have the SETI Institute, which is very optimistic about finding extrasolar life. And on the other hand, within the last couple of years, there's been a book published by Ward and Bromley called Rare Earth.
Yeah.
And that presents some of the more pessimistic or low probability sides. Like, they're not arguing there isn't any, but just that we might have overestimated the probability. And I think it's fascinating to compare both sides and come mm-hmm. to your own opinion. But it's remarkable that we live in the generation that has first found planets around other stars, and that we can not only ask these kind of questions, but we can potentially answer them.
Yeah, I know. This is, in a way, and the point that you bring up is so important. I mean, we've heard so much on the radio and TV lately about what are we going to tell our children when our children say, why are we living in these terrible times right now? My answer is that despite what's happening right now on this planet, these are amazing times to be alive. It's terribly exciting what's happening in science, what's happening in technology. We live in uncertain times, but there's an awful lot of wondrous things going on, and this is a great time to be alive.
Oh, it definitely is. When you think of medical things, biomedical things, nanotechnology,
yeah.
all the things that you and I are used to in astronomy, finding planets around other stars or oxygen in the atmospheres of other planets, it's truly amazing that we can sit here and actually live in this era.
Yes. Our guest today is Don McCarthy at Stewart Observatory at the University of Arizona. And Don, I have a question. I want to bring you back to a time back around 1985 when you were doing an observing project, and you came across something that has been fascinating. It's the story of a little object called Van Beesbroek 8B. Let's talk about that for a little bit.
Okay. Obviously, I was much younger then, but I was still an infrared astronomer,
yeah.
and I had realized through my own work that you could potentially see or record the infrared light from planet-like objects orbiting other stars. And we had begun to detect the heat emission from such objects. Now, those companions were stars in their own right, but it was potentially possible to see large brown dwarfs or objects just below the limit mm-hmm. of being a star. And so we targeted a few very faint stars in their own right to see if they had companions. And one of them was called Van Beesbrock number 8.
And Van B is, George Van Beesbrock is a, was a, incredibly assiduous observer. He died in the early 70s after observing. I think he, on his 84th birthday, still observing, still active, he got a night of observing on the 84-inch up at Kitt Peak. On his 90th birthday, he observed at the 90-inch up at Kitt Peak.
That's right.
He's an amazing man, but the star is one of his catalog stars.
Well, he compiled a list of the lowest luminosity, the lowest intrinsic brightness stars that were known, and his stars are still on that list of being record holders for some of the faintest we know of. And so we targeted number 8 on his list, and we used the 90-inch telescope as well, which seems fitting. And we thought we found the signature of a companion to that star. Now, you have to realize that back then, you could not take a two-dimensional picture in the infrared. You couldn't make a picture like you're used to seeing on a TV screen. We had one single detector, one pixel or picture element, if you will, and it would be sort of like with your hand curling your finger to make just a little hole, a little peephole, and you hold it up in front of your eye and you try to scan the world around you. You try to take a two-dimensional picture with a pinhole. And so that's the technique that we were using. And at the same time, the technique was trying to remove the blurring that occurs from the motion of air in the atmosphere, basically trying to take the twinkle mm-hmm. out of the starlight. And so we were trying to apply these techniques on this very faint VB8 star and thought we found the signature of a companion. And we did that at several infrared wavelengths over several months. We even used the 4-meter telescope on Kitt Peak to try to confirm it, and thought we had. And it took, well, I could talk forever about this, but we did announce that we had discovered a brown dwarf, VB8B.
I remember going, meeting you in the Arizona bookstore right around that time. It was just before the, I think it was the American Astronomical Society meeting. And you were out looking for material to do your poster on Van Beesbrock 8. And you said, I'm just looking for poster and material, and I need to get brown poster because it's a brown dwarf.
Yeah, right. Well, that was an important poster to put together to try to convince your colleagues that you had actually done something right and important. And I enjoyed putting that together. It turned out at the time that the equipment that we had, the infrared detector and the technique in which we used it, were truly state-of-the-art, and it took a couple years for other people to be able to duplicate that equipment and that observation. And the result was that the object was not confirmed something like a couple years later, and really hasn't been seen since. And the only explanation that I can come up with is a little technical, but it gets into the idea that the atmosphere is always changing. Starlight is always twinkling. And in order to cancel out the effect of that, you need to also make a measurement of the atmosphere itself, not just along the direction to the star mm-hmm. you're looking at, but off to one side or to another star. Mm-hmm. And possibly we looked a little too far away so that the light from the two different stars was not traveling through the same path, so that there might have been a so-called systematic difference. But I don't know, maybe someday VB8B will brighten up again and we'll all be surprised one more time. But the advantage was that it got people thinking.
I get the impression that you haven't quite given up on that.
No, I'm still not comfortable with that explanation.
That's because as we were talking before the show started, you were saying that this calibration error appeared in every telescope at the time that you used to observe this. which is really unusual.
Yeah, it would have had to behave the same way at different infrared wavelengths, different telescopes, different times of year. And
that's different nights.
And that's what makes me uncomfortable with it. And it's easy to say we made an observation. What it really is you had to take like 10,000 pictures or scans of an individual object and average them together. There's a lot of averaging that goes on, and that should average out changes in the atmosphere, but perhaps it didn't. I will continue to look at VB8 as time
goes on. So VB8 is still on your observing list.
Sure.
Yeah. What would you say? I mean, this is such an interesting thing story because science is rarely a building of one success on top of another. There's more a building of a learning process where we learn something from an observation and whether something is confirmed or not. And in fact, we often learn more when an observation leads us down a different road from the one that we thought it was leading us down, is what happened with BB8B. So what do you think that we learned out of that experience, and where can we go build on it?
Well, I think the fundamental thing, maybe two things, two fundamental things that we learned was, one, we actually do have the technology to see the direct emission from objects that are warm orbiting other stars. Those objects have a peak brightness in the infrared, and we have a technology that can see that. So up until then, the only techniques that were available for finding companions were indirect. Look at their effects on the star that they orbit. Do they make it wobble around? Do they make it come toward or away from us? Are there eclipses that happen? This sort of thing. So it gave people a new mindset that, hey, well, maybe we could actually see these objects directly and then learn what they're made out of and how fast they're moving and all the different kinds of measurements you can get with direct light. The other thing was, and this actually surprised me, we generated a big debate on what is a planet. To me at the time, we had potentially found an object that was not a star, but which orbited a star. And in a general sense, that to me was a planet. Mm. But there were a number of press interviews and articles and whatnot written. I came to find out that every different astronomer had a different idea of what a planet was.
Yeah.
And a lot of them were wrong. But when you look at our solar system, every object is different.
Mm-hmm.
And how can we define what a planet is on the basis of nine that are just different from each other?
And I'm so glad you said on the basis of nine, because those of us in the solar system are all familiar with the debate about Pluto, which I passionately feel is one of the nine major planets in our solar system. And that defines a planet at the small end. What you're doing is defining a planet at the large end, the difference between a planet and a star.
That's right. So my explanation or the way I responded to that kind of question was at the time to say, well, we don't have a cosmic census of a cosmic perspective of planets. We just know the nine in our solar system that are different.
Now it's 70.
Now it is 70.
Yeah.
And we're actually finding, at least on the basis of those 70, that our system is pretty unique.
Yeah.
But we also realize that the 70 we know of are sort of like the tip of the iceberg, and we're just able to penetrate into systems that might actually look like ours.
And who says we don't live in really exciting times right now, finding 70 worlds, most of them within the last couple of years.
Yeah,
in 1995, there were like one or two extrasolar planets, and now it's up to 70.
Well, that's how science also, or astronomy anyway, goes. Once you find the first example of something, you then know how to search for it.
Yeah.
Now, I'm fascinated by the idea that in 1995, they found the first extrasolar planet, but they did not need 1995 technology to do that. They could have done that, I believe, 20 years earlier. If they had thought that you could have a planet in closer than the orbit of Mercury to its star, making the kind of effect that it did.
And with our lovely music, we're announcing that our show is taking a news break. We will be back in 5 minutes with Don McCarthy on Let's Talk Stars. See you in a few.
You're listening to Starizona's Let's Talk Stars with your hosts, David and Wendy Levy. David is a science editor of Parade Magazine, the author of over 24 books, and the discoverer of 21 comets, including Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9. David and Wendy can also be heard on the World Wide Web at letstalkstars.com. Now here's David and Wendy.
Hello again. Welcome back to Let's Talk Stars. We got caught unawares there. Chapman had to get us out of an intense discussion we were having on the time of year that we could observe stars like Van Biesburg 8. It's in the summer sky. It's best to observe it in the summer sky, which is the worst time of year in Tucson because of the summer storms. But that means it's also good in the spring and in the fall, which is supposedly usually our best times. But Chapman, since you reminded us that it was time to get our show going again, we know that you have a question about infrared observing.
Well, I hope it's a good question. I remember seeing a special on the Discovery Channel, and in it they talked about infrared astronomy and how it was used to discover how old the universe was, and also how maybe the origins of the universe, how our universe was started. I'm curious if that's the case, and maybe our guest has some experience with that.
Don?
Well, I'm not a cosmological expert, but I think possibly what they might have been referring to is what's called the red shift, where the farther back in the universe you look, objects basically are redder and redder because their wavelengths have been stretched due to the expansion of the universe itself. And so, for example, some colors of light that a brand new star or galaxy might give out could be very blue or ultraviolet, but by the time it reaches you, traveling across the universe 10, 15 billion light years worth, it might appear in the infrared part of the spectrum. And of course, the infrared also lets you look through dusty regions. And like there was I don't know if you're familiar with the Hubble Deep Field, a very long exposure that the Hubble telescope took of an area near the Big Dipper. There's a visible version, a visible light version of that, and an infrared version of that. And the infrared does allow you to see that some objects in the visible that look separate are actually parts of the same galaxy, because you can look right through the dust and actually see that it's the same object. So you can with the infrared look back farther in time in that sense and get an idea of what the early universe was like.
One of the amazing things about studying astronomy in the infrared is that it reminds us that what our eyes can see is so small, such a narrow distorted vision of what the universe really is. We see this tunnel vision window into the cosmos that is called visible light, the stars, the galaxies, everything that we're familiar with. You're studying a little bit off on the left end of that, in the infrared. But then there's the ultraviolet on the other side, and then extreme ultraviolet, and then radio, and then X-ray, and gamma ray, and all kinds of things that we can actually now see. What we actually see in visible light is so small compared to what the universe really is.
Well, that's right. And within the last 50 years, we've been able to develop technologies to explore those wavelengths that our eyes just don't see. And that's led to all of the revolutions, you know, in astronomy, all the exotic kinds of objects and whatnot. And it probably makes astronomers more broad-minded because they realize that the visible part of the spectrum is just a teeny fraction of the total.
Now, the technology that astronomers have developed in the infrared is now being used in other areas, and certainly night vision. Infrared glasses allow pilots to be able to see targets at night. Did not all this really begin with the astronomers?
Well, yes, and it really is interesting to see the applications of what originally was basic research. So in the infrared, there's a company, for example, in Tucson, Infrared Labs, that makes an infrared microscope that the semiconductor industry can use to look inside of computer chips to see where the failure points are, and then they can improve the process. Or in the medical field, you can do infrared scans, if you will, of a person's body and see very subtle temperature differences that might result from abnormalities, perhaps precancer, on the skin. So the interesting thing is, you know, you ask these very basic questions. What's the sky like in the infrared? Or what happens if I made the air in this room so cold it froze? And you ask those basic questions, and then later on you find, oh, you know, I can use this for this purpose, for medicine, for night vision, for cooling detectors or whatever. But you can't go to your congressman initially and say, I want $1 million to see what happens when I freeze air, you know.
No, that's why the process of science doesn't lend itself to funding of science. You really don't know where a research road is going to go. And it's one of the interesting things about the research that you do. It's not specifically with a galaxy or even with a star in Van Biesburg's catalog, but in a type of observation. You're interested in everything that you can see in this particular part of the electromagnetic spectrum. It's just fascinating to me.
Well, that's right. And really, there's another area or another. The military has helped develop a lot of infrared technology. The first infrared detector I had said tank breaker on it. It was a hand-me-down from, who knows, 5 or 10 years earlier. And then after the Star Wars defense program, as part of that, after the Cold War was over, a lot of that technology was transferred down, and we've developed what's called adaptive optics based on military technology and ideas. So we're using that technology to look at stars and galaxies in a sharper way, benefiting from the whole military experience.
Yeah, adaptive optics is just a fascinating technological field with telescopes. And some, you know, as you're going outside at night, you look up at the sky and it's where the stars are twinkling. And I remember someone who was on a site survey to find out where to put the telescope that eventually ended up on the top of Palomar Mountain was going up some mountains in the area and spoke to a lady there who said, you know, I'm really glad you're thinking of putting the telescope on this particular mountain, because I want to tell you that I've never, ever seen the stars twinkle as much as they do from this particular mountain. And the astronomer said, oh, dear, we don't want the stars twinkling, because that really means that the air in our own atmosphere at that particular spot is messing around with the final journey of those stars, the light from those stars to the Earth. We want a place where the scene is as steady as we possibly can. What adaptive optics has done has made it possible to take a night when the seeing is not good and correct it. This is an amazing field.
That's right, and it's far from a perfected technique, too, but it does allow your telescope to behave in some ways as though it's above the atmosphere, and that's a huge advantage in cost. But we have a long way to go to make those images rock steady and solid as if the telescope really were
in space. Don, we've talked about Don McCarthy, our guest today on Let's Talk Stars from Stewart Observatory at the University of Arizona. Don, we've talked about a number of rather esoteric issues regarding to astronomy and to the universe today. And I think it might surprise most of our listeners and people here on KTKT and on our internet site, letstalkstars.com, who are listening to our program today. It might surprise some of them that you have probably done more for the education of young people than almost anyone else at the university in astronomy. There's been a big push there among others, but what you've done has been really special. A few years ago, you took over the directorship of the University of Arizona Astronomy Camp, and it has been my privilege to go up there every year up on Mount Lemmon and talk to the children. And what you have done, I mean, before you took over, the astronomy camp was actually existing for a few years, and they were able to use some of the older telescopes on top of Mount Lemmon and Mount Bigelow and the Catalinas. But since you've come on board, the children now get to use telescopes like the 61-inch, one of the best telescopes that the university has, trying to compete to get observing time for these children against other astronomers who want the telescope for their work and winning. And one of the things that I love about going out to that camp is to tell these children how they won a competition to use that telescope that night. They competed against professional astronomers who wanted that telescope. I think that the university astronomy camp is a wonderful thing. It's open to children all over the world. And I'd like you to tell us a little bit about it.
Oh, you'll have to stop me. Astronomy camp's been going on since 1988, and it's based on the idea that you learn by doing. I like an analogy to sports, because I like sports. But in a lot of science teaching, we teach people all the rules of the game and show them videos about how other people play it, but we never allow them to play it. And so astronomy camp lets students, in particular teenagers, use large telescopes and instruments under our guidance to do their own observing, their own projects, their own measurements. Depending on their age, some of them turn those into science fair projects. Some have gone to international science fairs and so on. And it's just fun to see how learning by doing or the hands-on approach can really change a person's approach to learning. So one of the fun things about directing the camp is that students stay in touch afterwards. And so these students who in 1989 might have been middle or junior high students are now graduating from law school or some from astronomy graduate school.
I can't believe that. I think they're all still kids. Like Dennis the Menace, they stay kids.
Well, I think what I do is I like to look in the eyes of a junior higher and see the potential. Now they have all the mood swings and everything else that goes with that age, but you see what they can become, and if they can get a glimmer of what they can become, then it is amazing what 1 week in the summertime on Mount Lemmon can do. And in some cases, it has totally changed the lives of our students.
We had one camper, Gil Escardo, a number of years ago, and he was certainly a ball of energy then, and now we've actually had him on our show as a guest a few months ago. He's involved in the Comet Search project with Wendy and me that we're doing right now. And he's just one of many. But these children, the enthusiasm, I wish everyone listening to this show could come and see these children at that telescope. The huge, 61-inch is a big telescope. 61-inch refers only to the size of the mirror. The telescope is long. It's massive. The dome that encloses it turns around with a rumble and a roar. And when the children are sitting there getting ready to use that telescope, it's a feeling like unlike any other. How can people, if they want to attend the camp, there are a number of aspects of it. There's for younger children, there's for older children, there's even one for adults. But people want to come to the camp. I know that the junior ones for the children is usually in June. The adults are at other times of the year. How do they get in touch with you?
Well, I give them my phone number and a website.
Okay, let's try the website.
I want me to dictate it here?
Sure.
It's this begins in the normal way, http://.
www.
Doesn't have the W.
It's
the most common mistake.
Okay.
It starts with a woman's name, Ethel.
Ethel.
E-T-H-E-L.
E-T-H-E-L, okay.
Dot, A as in Apple, S as in Sam, dot Arizona, spelled out, dot edu. One more slash.
Another slash.
And the word astrocamp.
Astrocamp.
All in lowercase.
Okay, so if people search on AstroCamp, they might find it.
Yep, or Astronomy
Camp. Or Astronomy Camp. So it's you don't have www. ethel.as.arizona.edu/AstroCamp. You are listening to Let's Talk Stars on AM 990 KTKT, your information station. I'm David Levy. Our guest today is Don McCarthy at Stewart Observatory, University of Arizona. Let's Talk Stars is sponsored by Star Arizona Adventures in Astronomy and Nature. The store is located at 5201 North Oracle Road, that's Oracle, just north of River, four nights a week on Monday night, Wednesday night, Friday night, and Saturday night. If you are anywhere in the area of Oracle and River, and that means anywhere in the western United States, it's worth your while to come and attend one of their star parties. I've been there. The enthusiasm, the excitement that Star Arizona provides by letting people just look through their telescopes, and it's getting better because we're entering the fall season. Saturn is coming up in the evening hours. Jupiter will be coming up soon. It is a wonderful opportunity to get into astronomy, especially right now. You're starting to think about what to get for Christmas, what present you might want to get for your child, for your parent. And the idea of a telescope is a wondrous thing, to buy a telescope as a gift. But what telescope to buy? The best advice I can give you is to go to one of the Arizona Star Parties and look through all the different telescopes they have set up there and decide which one is best for you. They have beginner's telescopes. They have telescopes that are very highly computerized. They have, in fact, a telescope there at Star Arizona that you simply set it up and turn it on. It finds north by itself. It finds a guide star by itself. You turn it on, do nothing, and then you just say, you type in, I want to go to Saturn, and it finds Saturn for you. It's amazing technology we have. All that available at Star Arizona Adventures in Astronomy and Nature, located at 5201 North Oracle Road. That's Oracle just north of River. If you're listening to our show on the web, try looking up their website at www.starizona.com. That's Star Arizona Adventures in Astronomy and Nature.
Are you tired of trying to figure out what kind of computer you need or what to do with the computer you have? Why not put Computers Etc. to work for you? Computers Etc. Incorporated is a full-service computer solutions provider. They build custom computer systems designed to meet your specific needs and also offer parts, accessories, and software. Their sales and support staff bring over 30 years of combined experience in computer sales and service, computer networking, and internet.
Find when you visit Skywatchers Inn, the Arizona Astronomy and Nature Retreat. Skywatchers Inn is located at an elevation of 3,860 feet on a hill overlooking the beautiful San Pedro River Valley, just minutes from the town of Benson and less than 30 minutes from Tucson. Skywatchers Inn is perfect for those interested in astronomy. It's adjacent to the Vega Bray Observatory, a privately owned astronomical observatory that houses 8 major telescopes. The Inn's facilities are perfect for nature and history lovers, photographers, bird watchers, amateur astronomers, or anyone simply curious about the cosmos. The bed, breakfast, and astronomy experience is quite unique at Skywatchers Inn. Visit them on the web at communiverse.com/skywatcher or call 520-615-3886. Enjoy the peace and comfort while you explore the wonders of Arizona and the universe at Skywatchers Inn.
Welcome to China Rose. China Rose Restaurant serves Tucson's finest Sichuan and Cantonese cuisine, as well as traditional hot and cold specialties. They'll delight you with their soups, salads, and appetizers. The China Rose lunch buffet is just $5.25, and dinner buffet, $6.99. Lunch and dinner specials include crab puffs, egg roll, and barbecued pork fried rice, along with your entrees such as sweet and sour pork, cashew chicken, lo mein, broccoli with chicken or beef, and many, many more to choose from. You must try their specialties, Mongolian beef, sesame chicken, and crab puffs. If you love great food and great ambiance, then you'll love the China Rose Restaurant. Located at the corner of Speedway and Rosemont, China Rose is open 7 days a week with a full menu and full-service bar. They also have available private meeting or banquet room for your business luncheon or family gathering. Gift certificates, party platters, and catering are available to fit any budget. China Rose Restaurant, 5101 East Speedway at Rosemont. The China Rose blooms the whole year round.
You're listening to Star Arizona's Let's Talk Stars with your hosts, David and Wendy Levy. David is a science editor of Parade Magazine, the author of over 2 dozen books, and the discoverer of 21 comets, including Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9. David and Wendy can also be heard on the World Wide Web at letstalkstars.com. Now here's David and Wendy.
And welcome back to Let's Talk Stars, where our guest is Don McCarthy of the University of Arizona, Don, you've been teaching astronomy students there for many, many years.
Oh, I'm not that old.
Well, I know that.
You're right.
Yeah. For, you've actually you follow in a tradition of teaching, importance of teaching in the astronomy department there. We both had a very dear friend, Bart Bach, who was there, director of Stewart Observatory in the astronomy department, very strongly built up the teaching aspect of it. And in the teaching you do, you're in both the introductory courses that you give and the other work you do, you have a tremendous emphasis on getting young people going in astronomy and in science and getting them properly grounded in our natural world.
Well, I've just seen, as I say, some of the inspirational and motivational aspects of turning people on to science. And my students this semester are undergraduates, and a lot of them, you know, tell me I'm no good at science or math. And yet I see when they come in to solve problems that they actually are good. And it really saddens me that they come with these preconceptions, if you will, or somewhere along the line someone has told them they're no good at science. And to me, science is exploring, and everybody explores. We all have different ways of learning and so on, and some are better at logical thinking, perhaps, than others. But I think everybody should be able to enjoy science, discover a few things for themselves, and see the relevance of it to society.
When I was growing up, I was told by various teachers that I was very bad in science, very bad in math. I wrote a composition in first grade called What I Did Last Summer, and it came back marked wrong. I grew up thinking that I wasn't good at anything, and then I just made that decision for myself that I'm going to be good at two things. I'm going to be good at astronomy, and I'm going to be good in English literature. And that was a battle. My English teacher in high school said I should go into something else. And it's young people today and in our generation really need to fight that they are. They're able to do things that they might think that they're not able to do.
And the whole exploring aspect, to me, is really important. We need to teach people to creatively explore. Well, I think one of the things that got me interested in education was when my fourth grade son years ago came armed to school with a pinhole and a 3x5 card, and there was a partial eclipse of the sun was going to happen. He was going to project it on another sheet of paper. And I got a message from the teacher saying it was a school district-wide policy not to let kids outside that day for fear they'd look at the sun. And education's not about fear.
Yeah.
And we should not teach people to fear things. We should teach them to respect, you know, electricity and so on. But there are ways you can explore and experience and discover, and we ought to be very creative in turning people on in that way.
And one of the things you and I are both going to do, and Wendy as well, and we're going to be going to Australia to see the Leonid meteors. We had an entire program. We had Rob McNaught here a few months ago talking about the prediction that the Leonids are going to be really pretty outstanding from Australia this fall. So you and I are going to go and lead a little expedition to try to count some meteors.
I'm looking forward to it. I never got to see it in 1966,
yeah,
33-ish years ago, but I've seen all of these pictures and everything. I've got to experience this.
It's something I need to do, too. And we have one other astronomer who's on our group as well.
Eric Hooper.
Yeah, and he's been a friend of yours for a long time. He's been active with the astronomy team.
Eric has got his Ph.D. in astronomy from Stewart Observatory several years ago, and still is active in our camps. He'll come back for the adult camp that we have this Friday, for example.
How what are the age groups for the adult camp? How does that
work? Any age for adult would work fine. We've had, you know, 21 to 82.
Oh, really?
We also have a camp for teachers in the summer. But the adult ones, there's typically one in the fall and one in the spring.
And to get information about any of the camps, you can just... It's ethel.as.arizona.edu/astrocamp, or just search for astrocamp. Don McCarthy, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure, David.
A lot of fun.
Thank you.
We've covered the gamut from infrared to astronomy education to trips to Australia to the origins of the universe. It's been a very wide-ranging program, and thank you for being a part of it. This has been Let's Talk Stars. See you next week.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Star Arizona.